Yarrow Mahmood was an 18th century slave in America, but he was something else too. He was a literate man who, once he gained his freedom, was a successful businessman, and famed portrait artist Charles Wilson Peale, who had painted George Washington, also painted him. By 1827, Mahmood's family had produced a Harvard grad. James Johnson has chronicled this remarkable story in a new book, From Slave Ship to Harvard, Yarrow Mahmood and the History of an African-American Family. James Johnson is a lawyer, writer, and lecturer in Washington. His work has appeared in the New York Times, Washington Post, Legal Times of Washington, and The American Lawyer. Black History Month starts on Saturday, but we're starting it right now. And Jim, nice to have you. Welcome to Kansas City. Welcome back to Kansas City.
Thank you, Steve. I'm glad to be here.
Now, how did you come across this story of Yarrow Mahmood?
I was at the library in Georgetown, the public library in Georgetown, and they have a second portrait of him, not as good. And I
saw not as good. Both in the book. Yeah.
I have both in the book, and it was by a Georgetown artist who was not on Peale's level, but in terms of talent. But he was a very interesting painting, and so I thought, well, you know, who is this guy? And then I Googled the name and saw this Peale painting, which is extraordinary. And that was the beginning of it.
The Peale painting being on the cover of the book.
It's on the cover of the book and in color, and it's some people think that's Peale's best painting.
You know, Yarrow Mahmood just absolutely glows in this portrait, even all these decades later. It's just an amazing portrait.
You should see it in real life. It's at the Philadelphia Museum of Art, and it really is extraordinary.
So you see the portrait, Jim, and so what happened next? What got you going on this thing?
A friend of mine is the director of the Smithsonian American Art Museum, and I asked her if she knew about the portrait, and she said no, but any portrait of an African-American prior to the Civil War was rare. And I had two of the same man, so I should do something. And then it just proceeded. You know, I would take one step at a time, and the story got bigger and bigger. And eventually I was able to trace the family all the way to Harvard. You said 1827. It was 1927.
Yeah, what am I thinking? I had it right? By 1927, right. He had produced a Harvard grad. That's right. I'm getting my centuries. Just 100 years. What's the big deal?
Well, it's surprising. It was only four generations.
Mm-hmm.
And they knew each other. So it's not like, I mean, you know, you can trace the family. The woman who passed away in 1956, she knew his daughter-in-law. And then, of course, the daughter-in-law knew him. So, you know, people around today knew the woman who died in 56.
But still, there's something about this story. I mean, you point out you've seen the portraits and you wonder what was going on here. But you've invested an enormous amount of time going back and tracing these families and looking at records. What was it about their story that just grabbed you by the collar so vigorously and wouldn't let you go?
Two things. First of all, you don't have this kind of record about a family. And secondly, they were extraordinary. I should say three things. Secondly, they were extraordinary people. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is the unfairness, because you can really identify with, there's enough about this family where I'm white and I could identify with this black family and really identify with the unfairness. And they always were able to, you know, forge ahead, and they seem not discouraged by the problems they had.
You had never heard of him before, just to be clear.
That's
about
correct.
That.
That's right.
Yeah. He came here, Yarrow Mahmood, from Guinea on the west coast of Africa. How did it turn out that he one day found himself, I think with his sister, on the slave ship Elijah, bound for Maryland, of all places?
He was a Fulani Muslim, and so he was a Muslim, and that was very unusual. The reason, what was going on in Africa at the time was there was warfare between the Muslims and the non-Muslims, and the slave ships would go over and buy prisoners of war. And so whoever got captured got sold into slavery. Usually the Muslims won these battles because they were educated and they had European weapons, but sometimes they lost and they got sold to the slave ships. And the slave ship captains didn't care.
What do we know about Yarrow's the transportation, the trip over from Guinea to Maryland?
The slave ships were terrible, and that's why I emphasize from slave ship. People were shackled, put below decks. It was just terrible conditions. 20% would usually die on a voyage of disease. And, you know, you take a man like Yarrow, who was educated, he could read and write, and so you can imagine yourself put on a slave ship and how terrible those conditions would be for you.
What did he say about the experience later in his life?
He never talked about it. Not to the extent anyone recorded it.
Where did he wind up once he got here, Jim? What was sort of the end point for him?
The ship docked at Annapolis, Maryland, where the Naval Academy is. Literally where the Naval Academy is. And then he was purchased by a man named Bell, and that was a very prominent family in Maryland. And his particular man who owned him was an engineer and a revolutionary, participated in the American Revolution for Maryland. So he was a very prominent man. He knew people like George Washington and the Founding Fathers. So Yarrow was at a pretty high level, and he was a body servant.
I was going to say, he became sort of his right-hand man, yes. If I understand correctly. Yeah. What kind of relationship did they have, and what did Yarrow do for him exactly?
Well, a body servant was really not a valet. He was someone who went with you all day. So if a man like Bell was moving around the state of Maryland, owning many properties and doing all these things, Yarrow would follow him around all day, and it'd be a second gun because it wasn't safe then. It'd be a man you'd talk to, somebody you could have a conversation with. And from Yarrow, it meant he met all these important people. And later, when he got free and settled in Georgetown, where all the founders of Maryland settled, he had met them prior through the Bell family.
How did Bell treat him, Jim?
Very well. He was, so far as we know, they set him free eventually. The grandson of the man who bought him set him free. And he said, you've worked enough for us, and it's time for you to go work for yourself now. So they allowed him to be free. They, helped him transition from slavery into a free man. And he became a very important businessman in Georgetown. He was mm-hmm. loaning money to white merchants. He was a brickmaker. He was making money, saving it. And then he knew enough that he'd loan money to people, and he actually bought bank stock.
Well, at one point, and I don't want to get too far away from this point, that when his ship landed from Guinea and the slaves were unloaded, you write in here that there's a pretty good chance that this famed portrait artist, Charles Wilson Peale, who was roughly the same age as Yarrow, very well could have been on the dock that day or nearby watching those ships, the slaves be unloaded, and may have seen Yarrow at that point in his life.
Yeah, the slave ships into Annapolis were not very common, maybe once a year. A slave ship directly from Africa was very uncommon. And so Peale was 11 years old. Yarrow was 16. So you can imagine if you're an 11-year-old boy, there were only 150 homes in Annapolis at the time. All the boys would have gone down to the dock to see this unusual event. And I'm sure that Peale saw Yarrow. But Peale believed, when they met much later, Peale believed that Yarrow was 140 years old.
140. I was going to ask you, what on earth caused him to believe that Yarrow Mahmood was 140 years old?
Yarrow would let that story be out. That was a story. Apparently, Yarrow liked to pull people's legs. And so he was very happy to have people think he was 140.
So again, he was treated pretty well. Tell us about Yarrow's family, his wife, and sort of how the family began to grow.
He had he didn't have a child until he was 51 years old.
Wow.
And that was to a woman on an adjoining tobacco plantation or tobacco farm. And then she was a slave. So he got his freedom. She did not. But he bought his son's freedom. He only had one child that we know of, and he bought that boy's freedom when he was 7 years old, moved him from a tobacco plantation into Georgetown, and had him educated to the best he could. The boy could read and write, grew up to be a man, and could read and write.
Why did Yarrow wait till he was 51 to have kids?
I don't know. I think probably it was just the conditions of slavery. It was hard to have any sort of meaningful relationship as a slave. And then as an older man, he realized that time was passing on him, and he seemed to settle down.
Tell us about Yarrow's son. Who was he?
Yarrow used the name Yarrow as a last name, even though he put it first. So his son's name was Aquila Yarrow, and his son was educated, could read and write, married a woman on an adjacent tobacco farm, and then moved up to the small little farming community in Maryland, very far away from Georgetown. I think that's the reason they moved up there. And then he died of cholera in 1832 when he was only about 40 years old.
Hmm. And how did Yarrow react to that? Do you have any sense?
Well, Yarrow had passed away by that time.
Okay.
But it was Aquila Yarrow, his son's wife, who became famous. And that part of Maryland, that area of Maryland, is known as Yarrowsburg because of her. She was the midwife there. And she was a very dominant personality there. until she died in 1885.
Is it still known that way today?
Yes.
That's amazing. Well, in the course of his years in Maryland, Yarrow Mahmood became so well known that he attracted the attention, as I said, of the famed portrait artist Charles Wilson Peale. Again, this portrait's on the cover of your book, From Slave Ship to Harvard. Why would Charles Wilson Peale be interested in painting a former slave?
Well, he thought he was 140 years old, so there was a scientific interest.
A natural curiosity
right
there, yeah.
So there's a scientific interest there, and Peale was interested in science. But I think above and beyond that, he heard that Yarrow owned bank stock. He was a free man with a house and a lot. And although Peale himself had owned slaves when he was young, by this time in his life, he was starting to believe that blacks and whites were equal. And so when he heard that there was a black man who was an entrepreneur in Georgetown, a financier in Georgetown, he wanted to paint the portrait. And if you look at the portrait, it really looks like a wealthy Georgetowner who mm-hmm. happens to be black.
Yes.
And I think that's the way Peale painted it.
What do we know about their relationship during those sittings? You talk about it a little bit in the book. What happened during that time, and what kind of conversations did they have?
In those conversations, we know that they talked about how Yarrow came to America, the name of the slave ship captain, and some things like that. But the thing that is abundantly clear is that Yarrow was a charming man, and he charmed Peale. And Peale stayed in touch with him. And so when Yarrow died 4 years after this painting, Peale wrote an obituary. Peale's living in Philadelphia. He's not living in Georgetown. He's living in Philadelphia. He wrote an obituary and put it in the Philadelphia newspapers.
What did he say about him?
He said Yarrow was 140 years old.
He stayed with that story,
right,
whether it was true or not. Yeah.
He said that he was a Muslim, that he was buried in the yard of his house. And the part I like, and he tells about his owning stock and things, but the part I like best is at the end of the obituary, it says, Yarrow was never known to eat of swine nor drink ardent spirits. And that was the litmus test in those days of a Muslim, is they wouldn't eat pork and he wouldn't drink alcohol.
Did Peale understand that, or was he just sort of upholding him as some sort of paragon of virtue here?
Well, both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 816-235-2888 is our phone number here. We're talking about a man who, a former slave whose family produced a Harvard grad in 1927. The book is titled From Slave Ship to Harvard, Yarrow Mahmood and the History of an African-American Family. The author is James H. Johnson. He'll be speaking in town this weekend at the Black Archives of Mid-America, 1722 East 17th Terrace in Kansas City. That'll be on Saturday afternoon, 2 o'clock. You can RSVP at info@blackarchives.org to hear and see Jim Johnston tomorrow afternoon, 2 o'clock at the Black Archives of Mid-America, 1722 East 17th Terrace. You know, I'm just putting myself in your shoes a little bit, Jim, that this idea that you wrote this book and invested so much time in this story, to have been in that room with Charles Wilson Peale and Yarrow Mahmood when that painting was being done, how much money you would have paid to have been a fly in the wall for that conversation.
Well, I think everybody would have been.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I say it would make a great stage play, because you could just have two people and you could tell this whole story with just two people talking.
What do you imagine they talked about?
Oh, I think they talked about Yarrow's life. I don't think they talked about his life in Africa, but I think they talked about his outlook on life. He was very religious, but a Muslim, and I think Peale could see that Yarrow felt about religion just the way everybody feels about religion. It just happened to be a different religion, and that he was a good, decent human being.
So take the family then through the years. Yarrow lived, what year did he die?
He lived from 1736 to 1823. He died in 1823. Then his son, as I said, lived till
86, 87, if I'm doing
right.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then his son didn't live very much past his death, for about 10 years past Yarrow's death. But Yarrow's daughter-in-law lived until 1885. And it was her family that then went on to Harvard. It was her nephew went into the army during the Civil War, fought for the Union during the Civil War. And then it was that man's daughter was the first in the family to get a college education. And then that man's grandson went to Harvard in 1923 and graduated in 27.
Hmm. And what did he do? How successful was he?
He was very successful, you know, given the times. He went back to his home of Baltimore and ended up vice principal of a school. Then during World War II, he enlisted in the Army at age 40 and was a military policeman. And then after the Second World War, he used the GI Bill to get a master's degree. But the University of Maryland was still segregated, so he couldn't get into the University of Maryland. So he went to Columbia. So he had a degree from two Ivy League schools.
This is Robert Turner Ford
Robert Turner Ford.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what does this book wind up telling us about race relations in America? Because, you know, there is this sense you get from reading it that relationships between blacks and whites were far more complex, and the races may be far more dependent on each other than people might have thought, Jim. How were relationships between blacks and whites more complex than some might have thought back in those days?
Well, Samuel Bell, who owned Yarra first, and Yarra himself, really were more friends. I mean, there was, in fact, the legality that one was a slave of the other. But Samuel Bell obviously understood Yarra had a lot of talent and respected him for it, and the Bell family respected him for it. And they knew that Yarra was working for them. And then when it came time for Yarra to get free, they helped him get free, they helped him get business, and they helped him start life on his own, and they stayed in touch with him. I think the fact that when his son moved to rural Maryland, I think the Bell family helped arrange that. They knew people up in the other part of Maryland who could help him settle down, because a black man settling in rural Maryland in those days would have been a very, very difficult thing.
So the point being what then? What are you driving at here in terms of the relationship between one-time slaves and their owners?
Well, that the owners helped the slave sort of as a protege, understanding that there is still the racial divide that no one can deny, but they would help them as if they liked them and they got along well, they viewed them more as a protege who was of a different race than really of someone that they could demean.
Did Yarra leave behind much of a record, Jim, as to what he thought about all this stuff?
Oh, I only have one quote in the book, and there's only one time he is quoted in his language. And that's very interesting because you get a feel for the man.
In his language being?
It was in dialect, because bear in mind he was Fulani Muslim, so his first language was Fulani. His second language was Arabic. He may have spoken French because Senegal is French. And then he had English. But there is this wonderful poetry in his language. He says, the owner got a lot of work out of the yarrow bone, and he knows that his name rhymes with morrow and marrow bone. And so he's making a play on words, even though he's operating in a third or fourth language. And so there's this wonderful poetry in his language.
This notion, again, that the relationships then between blacks and whites were more complex, what you're talking about then is this affinity between owner and slave that maybe people tend to overlook today.
Well, and I not only overlook, but I do think that later that went away. You know, the early generations of Americans were a lot more tolerant. There was a lot less racism there than developed later with the cotton plantations that came along later and the Deep South. And that's where racism really took a very, very nasty turn. But at that time, it seemed a healthy respect between the races that then, by the time of the Civil War, really got into terrible conditions.
Hmm. On your blog, you talk about the destruction of Yarrow Mahmood's home, I think just last year, Jim.
This year. Well, I mean, 2013.
Yeah, right, that's what I meant. Yeah, and the lack of effort by historic preservationists to hang on to it. What happened there?
Well, the house itself was not his, but the bricks in the cellar, he was a brickmaker, and there's good evidence that the bricks in the cellar were made by him, and you know, they had been on the property and reused for a cellar. And, of course, there's archaeology around the yard, because if you dig in the yard, you may find something that he once had. And, of course, he's buried there. So I thought that was...
You have a picture of where he's buried in the book, maybe back in the northeast corner.
Right. Well, southeast, because he'd be facing Mecca.
You know, okay, right.
With a good Muslim. But the city, you know, just sort of responded to the money and the neighbors complained about the house, so the house was demolished.
Why did they complain about the house?
A tree had fallen on the house, and the owner wasn't taking care of it. So it was just this eyesore with rats in it and stuff like that. You could sympathize with the neighbors, but what the city didn't do was do the archaeology before they tore the house down and before they destroyed these bricks. I think there's still some hope that they could do some work, but it would have been a lot better to do it before rather than after they put the bulldozers.
But the home is off the face of the earth now.
Yes.
But the ground is still...
I don't know what's in the ground. I think maybe they did leave some of the bricks in the cellar because they just filled it in, and that those can be dug up by archaeologists if they'd ever get around to it.
So he's buried actually right there in the lot.
It was adjacent to the Presbyterian Cemetery. So I think it was not a big deal to bury him on his lot because beyond that fence was the cemetery. And so, it was 50 feet.
You know, I'm just curious about the current generation, his ancestors today. There's pictures, again, in the book of them. Tell us about the family.
Well, they're wonderful people. The people I know are four women in their 60s and 70s, and there were originally five. One died since the book was published. But of those five women, there were eight college degrees. So each of them had a bachelor's degree, and three of them had master's degree, and they were all teachers. So they're just brilliant women, elegant people, fantastic people. One of them told me, she said, I never thought of our family as special. And I said, your great-grandfather fought in the Civil War, and your uncle went to Harvard in 1923, and you don't think you were special? And she said, well, I never looked at it that way.
Huh. They must have loved hearing the stories that you came up with about their own family.
They did. They did. And they actually said they live in Baltimore, and they said they'd like to be in Kansas City today, this weekend, to hear this talk, because they have heard a couple of them, and so they love it. They just love it.
What would you ask him today, Jim, if you had the chance? Because I can only imagine, again, there's a whole bunch of things you'd like to clarify with Jarl Mahmood.
I'd just like to hear him talk. It's not anything specific. I'd just like to hear him talk because I think he probably was just a charming human being, and he would probably just move your soul with his talk.
James Johnson's new book, From Slave Ship to Harvard, Jarl Mahmood and the History of American African-American Family, is out. He'll be speaking about the book tomorrow afternoon, that Saturday, from 2 to 4 at the Black Archives of Mid-America, that address, 1722 East 17th Street. For more information or to RSVP, just email info@blackarchives.org. And Jim, what a pleasure to have you here. Thanks for sharing your story with us. I sure appreciate it.
Thank you.